It is Tuesday, December 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Russian authorities discover the flight data recorder from the plane that crashed into the Black Sea over the weekend.
The only thing we do know from authorities is that they were very quick to dismiss the possibility of terrorism.
Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe and U.S. President Barack Obama prepare to visit the site of the Japanese attack in Pearl Harbor that brought the U.S. into World War II, and we find why the Disney movie Moana is popular with holiday filmgoers. It's all ahead. Russia's defense ministry said Tuesday search teams have found the main flight data recorder from a military passenger plane that crashed over the weekend in the Black Sea. All 92 people on board the plane were killed. The defense ministry said that as of early Tuesday, search crews had found 12 bodies and many more body parts. Among the victims were 68 members of the Alexandrov Ensemble, a military choir, orchestra, and dance group that was to give a New Year's performance for Russian airmen at the military base near Latakia. I spoke to VOA Moscow correspondent Daniel Scharf about the investigation.
Well, we don't know a whole lot in terms of what caused the crash. There are a few different working theories that are going around. One possibility of the plane possibly having been overloaded. Another possibility that there might have been something wrong with the fuel quality. There's also a theory that something might have gotten into the engine or flown into the engine, causing the plane to go down, to lose control. The only thing we do know from authorities is that they were very quick to dismiss the possibility of terrorism. That was something that came out fairly early on before the investigation had really been underway. So that was something that they wanted to do to try and reassure the public very quickly. And also because it's a military plane, if there would be an attack, a terrorist attack on a military plane, of course, the implications of security breaches and so forth would be huge. So they came out very quickly saying that that was not a possibility as far as most of the authorities are concerned, that they're not pursuing that as a possible cause. At the same time, though, we've seen some other officials saying that, you know, they're not going to make a final conclusion until they've completed the investigation. And, of course, today they did recover the first of three black box recorders, the flight data recorder, which is the main one. And that has arrived in Moscow today, and they're going to be cleaning it up and trying to get as much information as they can out of it. According to officials and Russian media reports today, they say that they may be able to get some information as soon as Friday of this week, but that it could take several weeks to get all of the information out of the black box recorder and to fully determine what may have been the cause of this crash.
What has been the reaction in Russia to this, particularly occurring at this time of year?
Well, of course, there's been a huge outpouring of grief and also support for the loss of the 92 people on board this plane. It included not only some military personnel, but over 60 members of this military ensemble of choir, orchestra, dancers. So it was a very big loss for people who were, you know, supporters and fans of these performers. They were not soldiers, of course, in the sense of being out on the battlefield, but they were members of this military ensemble that was quite well known. Also on board was Elizaveta Blinka, who's commonly known as Dr. Liza, a very well-known humanitarian aid worker who had dedicated her life to helping out the less fortunate here in Russia and also in eastern Ukraine. And so that was certainly something that was very shocking for the communities of humanitarian rights workers and aid workers here in Russia.
Well, now, the timing of this plane crash, this occurs very close to the assassination of Russia's ambassador in Turkey. Is there a concern about that?
Of course, when the military plane first went down, there was a lot of speculation and, of course, concern that this could have been something related to terrorism. And although it has not been completely and officially ruled out, of course, as you know, we were talking about earlier, the Russian officials were quick to try and dismiss it. At least some prominent Russian officials were quick to dismiss the possibility of terrorism. But it did raise a lot of eyebrows when this military plane went down. so soon after this assassination of the Russian ambassador in Turkey, because the assassin, of course, was relating his actions, his killing the ambassador, to Russia's intervention militarily in Aleppo in Syria. And this military plane was flying from Sochi to Syria, to Russia's military base in Syria, to this band was going there to perform, and Dr. Lisa was going there to bring medical supplies that she was donating to a hospital in Syria. So certainly there is a connection to Syria, and that did raise a lot of concerns that there may have been a motive for an attack on this plane.
That's VOA Moscow correspondent Daniel Scharf. Well, joining me by phone today is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. So, Andrew, what's trending?
Well, all eyes today are on Pearl Harbor in Hawaii as Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe prepares to lay a wreath there and meet with President Obama. This comes just months after President Obama went to Hiroshima in a historic visit. So a lot of people on social media talking about what a huge step this is for U.S.-Japan relations. But a lot of people saying, talking about this issue of the apology, there will not be a formal apology for Pearl Harbor from Japan. But there's a question of, do they need to apologize 75 years after the fact? Haven't we moved on enough? There's also people who are angry that there's no apology. So that issue from both sides getting a lot of attention on social media. And the other big trending topic today here in the U.S. is Dow 20,000. The Dow Jones stock market prepares to approach that record-breaking 20,000 number. It's about 50 points away as of right now. And it's actually quite funny. There are a lot of people talking about how momentous this is, but then others pointing out, you know what, a lot of people who are saying what a great thing this is don't even have stock accounts and aren't even affected. Still others are saying, even if you don't trade in stocks, that this is going to affect you in terms of your jobs and personal economy. So a number that a lot of people are watching here in New York and certainly around the U.S. and around the world.
All right. Thanks very much, Andrew. And we will be having more on the Pearl Harbor story later on in the program. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky.
This is Science in a Minute.
A new preliminary study from the American Heart Association suggests that women with a history of migraines may also have an increased risk of stroke. Researchers in Florida studied over 900 women who, at the time, were being assessed for heart disease. Of the women studied, 224, or about 25% of them, reported a history of migraine headaches. The study suggests that compared to the women who did not report any migraines, those who did were found to have an 83% higher risk of some kind of cardiovascular event, such as either a stroke or heart attack, within an average 6-year follow-up. Compared to those who didn't have migraines, women with a history of migraine were also found to be a little more than twice as likely to suffer a stroke during the study. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Here are some of the top news stories trending. The new Somali parliament takes office amid high hopes but charges of graft. U.S. Senator John McCain in Estonia defends the need for NATO to deter Russia. Iraqi authorities search for an abducted journalist, and Thailand is expanding relations with China amid a pivot to other nations. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA. This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we look at Disney's latest release. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's historic visit Tuesday to the Pearl Harbor Memorial, erected over the rusting, sunken hulk of the battleship Arizona, is aimed at showing the strength of the U.S.-Japanese alliance. It's the scene of the infamous surprise Japanese aerial attack in 1941 on American naval and air forces in Hawaii that thrust the U.S. into World War II. Jeffrey Hornung, research fellow at the Washington-based Sasakawa Peace Foundation, a U.S.-Japan think tank, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty the visit is intended to send a message. The recipients, he said, are President-elect Donald Trump, who has been critical of Japan's financial support of the U.S. military presence, as well as the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Management, and Japan's Asian neighbors.
It sends a symbolic message to not only the incoming president-elect, but also to the region, that the U.S.-Japan alliance is stronger than ever, that we are able to confront past problems between us and still be stronger as allies.
Is China, do you think, watching this closely?
I hope so. I hope that both China and other countries that may have some ill feelings towards Japan look at this and see that even though Japan has done some horrible things in its imperial past, that it is able to confront these past ghosts and overcome it. But I also hope that China in particular and North Korea see this, that the U.S.-Japan alliance, no matter what friction the recent presidential election here in the United States has caused, that the allies are stronger than ever and are able to look forward and hopefully look at challenges in the same way.
Young people in both Japan and the U.S. barely even know what Pearl Harbor stands for, but this obviously is a trip with historical significance.
When it first broke, he would be the first prime minister to ever visit Pearl Harbor, but in fact, in the recent weeks, we've learned that he will be the fourth prime minister. However, he will be the first prime minister to visit the Arizona. And of course, a lot of the younger generation don't know the significance of Pearl Harbor, but given that these two countries were bitter rivals and enemies just two or three generations ago, it's amazing that they have been able to come this far and reconcile their past histories.
I want to speak about incoming President-elect Donald Trump, who has been critical of the U.S. military presence in Japan, as well as pledging to pull out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Pact. How concerning is this to Japanese leaders?
The failure of the TPP, even under the Obama administration, has been concerning because Prime Minister Abe put a lot of political capital into this. He had to confront some agricultural cooperatives within his own country and really confront opposition with his own party with this to be able to push it through his country. And in regards to security issues, there's been some talk during the campaign about belittling Japan's importance for security, talking about the cost of U.S. troops. And all this was taken very negatively in Japan because the narrative for really the last couple of years is that the U.S.-Japan alliance is the strongest it's ever been.
That is Jeffrey Hornung of the Sasakawa Peace Foundation. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
This is International Edition. Disney's latest animated movie, Moana, is riding a wave of popularity around the globe. It's inspired by the folklore of the Pacific Islands. Scholars say for centuries, some of the ancient world's greatest navigators discovered and settled the many islands of Oceania. But about 3,000 years ago, those voyagers stopped for about 1,000 years, and no one knows why. That's where Moana, which means ocean in many Polynesian languages, begins, as Heidi Chang reports.
The film tells the story of Moana, a young girl growing up on a fictional island in the Pacific. She's drawn to the sea, but her father forbids her from sailing beyond the reef. However, when their food supply begins to dwindle and fish start dying, Moana sets sail into the open ocean to save her people by finding a demigod named Maui. Native Hawaiian teenager Ali'i Carvalho is the voice of the Polynesian heroine.
Maui, shapeshifter, demigod of the wind and sea, I am Moana.
Hero of men.
What?
It's actually Maui, shapeshifter, demigod of the wind and sea, hero of men. I interrupted from the top. Hero of men. Go.
Maui, voiced by Dwayne Johnson, who's part Samoan, guides Moana in her quest to become a wayfinder, navigating only by the signs of nature. In doing so, she discovers her identity.
Teach me to sail. My job is to deliver Maui across the great ocean. I should be sailing.
It's called wayfinding, princess. It's not just sails and knots. It's seeing where you're going in your mind. Knowing where you are by knowing where you've been.
Screenwriter Aaron Kendall grew up in Hawaii and drew on his wayfinding training with master navigator Nainoa Thompson to accurately portray the traditional skill. He says the lessons he learned from Thompson continue to guide him.
What Nainoa said is whatever you want to achieve, whether it's literally sailing to an island as Moana does in the movie, or if it's, you know, getting your dream job, or any goal that you have in life, you can reach it no matter how impossible or far away it seems if you hold the island in your heart and in your mind.
That connection with ancestral knowledge in the movie appeals to Manulani Aluli Meyer, director of Indigenous Education at the University of Hawaii West Oahu. She was especially moved by a scene in which Moana's grandmother encourages her to discover the wisdom of her ancestors.
When the kupuna said, go into this blocked-off cave and see who you are, and then, and you just saw the canoes, I cried at that because we are wayfinders. We go where nobody else has gone. We have sailed the open ocean when Europeans thought it ended. And I love the idea that we are wayfinding again, and that is pivotal for our people, for my people in Hawaii, that we are finding ourselves by going outward to find our inward strength.
Kandel's twin brother, Jordan, was also part of the screenwriting team and says even though it's set in a remote part of Oceania eons ago, Moana's story is a universal one.
As an American in a world in which we've had a first female try to break the glass ceiling in the highest office of our land, to tell a story for girls, for my own 4-year-old daughter, for women everywhere, that whatever you believe in, whatever you want, you can achieve. I think that message for today's world only continues to be incredibly important. And I think that's what makes it timely.
That message resonates with filmgoers like 16-year-old Lauren Trujillo, who has a personal connection to Moana.
I loved it so much. Seeing my best friend, Ali'i Carvalho, be the voice of Moana, it was just really emotional for me, and I'm so proud of her and everything she's accomplished. I feel very empowered after watching it. I feel like I can do anything now.
For VOA News, I'm Heidi Chang in Honolulu.
Thanks very much, Heidi. Well, we hear more and more about social media these days, and the U.S. government wants to know about that. The government has started asking some foreign visitors to provide their social media account information as part of the effort to identify potential terrorists. Since last week, foreigners arriving here in the U.S. on the visa waiver program are asked to identify the social media platforms they use as well as their account names. Even though the request is optional, and U.S. officials have said they would not deny entry to anyone who declines to disclose the information, the move has generated a backlash from civil rights groups as well as the tech industry. Groups such as the American Civil Liberties Union and the Center for Democracy and Technology have warned that the move could potentially offer the government gateways into an enormous amount of users' online expression and associations, which can reflect highly sensitive information about that person's opinions, beliefs, identity, and community. Critics are also warning that the program could be used to target Arabs and Muslims and expose them to intense scrutiny. A group that represents companies including Facebook, Twitter, and Google, the Internet Association, argues that the new policy threatens free expression. Currently, visitors from 38 countries are able to use the visa waiver program that allows them to travel and stay in the United States for up to 90 days without a visa. Well, please look at our website at voanews.com. We have a number of stories there that you should be interested in, and there's more you can read about some of the stories we've covered here on the program. Well, that is our show for today. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Promoting the human rights of persons with disabilities has been a key objective of U.S. President Barack Obama's administration, both at home and internationally. Disability rights are not abstract concepts, wrote Secretary of State John Kerry. They are about things you can see and touch that make a difference. They are about sidewalks with curb cuts, public buildings with accessible bathrooms, restaurants, stores, hotels, and universities with ramps and elevator access, buses with lifts, and train platforms with tactile strips. Judy Heumann is the United States' first special advisor for international disability rights. She came to the State Department to help implement the United Nations Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, which the U.S. is a signatory to. During her tenure, she has used diplomacy to promote disability rights worldwide.
According to the World Bank and the World Health Organization, at least 15% of the world's population have disabilities. When you are excluding a large percentage of a population, it has economic implications on the country, needless economic consequences. So we try to work both with civil societies and other countries and government to make them recognize that disabled people can make the same contributions as other people if those barriers are removed.
Special Advisor Heumann, who is herself a wheelchair rider, has traveled to nearly 40 countries to engage governments and civil society on disability rights. Her team has worked to empower the voices of disabled people's organizations, helping them to help their governments draft laws that protect disabled persons from discrimination. She has worked with the State Department to expand visitors and exchange programs so that government and non-governmental representatives can learn firsthand how the Americans with Disabilities Act is implemented in the United States. Special Advisor Heumann and her team have trained State Department staff to create more inclusive environments in U.S. embassies and to recognize and document abuses of disability rights in some countries for inclusion in the congressionally mandated country reports on human rights practices. Our work, said Special Advisor Heumann, is to encourage disabled people to fight for their rights, to give them needed information on how to do it, and to encourage governments to do ultimately what I think they realize is the right thing.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.